You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanl Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Laura Fortunato. She's an evolutionary anthropologist at the University of Oxford, and she's external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here, and we're talking today about marriage, monogamy, polygamy, family systems, and all of these things are things that you study in the context of complexity science. They're also things that everybody's really interested in. And it's very interesting to me because, like social science, it's not like you've got a fossil record. You have to find other methods to understand. I mean, you can look at how people are living today or 100 years ago, but how do we know what we do know about how people lived hundreds or even thousands of years ago or more?
So we can make some inferences about that, for example, from the patterns that we see in the archaeological record. And so if you have a big house with several rooms, then you might assume that that's where a big extended family lived as opposed to a smaller house. And so you can look at how that changed over time as well. So we can make some inferences from that. Of course, there's some interpretation that has to go on, assuming that in the past, like now, big house meant larger family. Alternatively, you can look at the genetic data and see whether there is a variation in the number of mating partners for males and females, and there's a trace of that in the genetic data. And that's very interesting. It doesn't tell you very much necessarily about the marriage and family systems. It tells you about the mating pattern that was going on. So we have to distinguish between those two levels.
Well, how is marriage defined? I mean, I think of it as a legal or religious phenomenon.
In our Western context, it is. In anthropology, we've been interested in understanding how marriage can be defined in a way that applies across cultures. So it's not just our own understanding of marriage. And that's been actually quite hard to do. So a lot of ink has been spilled in anthropology to try and define marriage in a way that was more universal, if you like, or more applicable across societies. And so it's hard to do because there is quite a lot of variation. We don't appreciate how much variation there is across societies.
What are some of those variations?
So the one case that threw anthropologists off in the 1950s and 60s are groups in South India, the Nayar, in which they have what is called in anthropology visiting marriage. So the wives or the women effectively live with their family and their husbands visit at night. But they don't live together with the wives. And so it's a visiting marriage arrangement. And so to fit that in with our understanding of marriage, where the bride and groom set up a household, either an independent household or together with their kin, you have to be a little bit careful about how they find things to make sure that you capture the whole range.
In both of those cases, whether it's like a visiting marriage or somebody setting up a household or living with their parents, extended families, whatever, it's still about sexuality, right?
It is. Definitely there is that aspect. And so we can define marriage in a way that includes that aspect. But there is also a lot of other stuff going on, for example, the social recognition. So it's not just two people hooking up. It's also, is that relationship normatively endorsed by others in the community? Is it socially recognized as a relationship? So I think that's perhaps what distinguishes marriage from just mating.
I think a lot of people who get married do so in ceremony because they want to make those vows in the presence of a lot of people. And when marriages start to get tricky, they have the support of those people. That's something that we experience now. Is that also like part of the kind of longer term picture?
I think, yes, probably that was going on. I think relating to that aspect, you also have, of course, the notion that marriage is associated with inheritance and property. and how those two things go together. And so if you have a family with a lot of property to be transferred across generations, then other considerations come in, issues like legitimacy, for example. And then, yes, there is also the support of kin, and it's not just two individuals who get married, two or more individuals, it's also the families who effectively strike these arrangements, that you see a lot of that across societies.
And in European history, it's sometimes entire countries getting married, right? When the prince of one country and the princess of another.
That's the extreme case where you have a lot of material wealth, and not just material wealth, but also social influence that is linked to who is married whom. And so, yeah, then issues about paternity and legitimacy become very important in those cases.
What do we know about the earliest, I mean, what are the earliest records we have of marriage? Is that a like the era of agriculture?
So you can look at the archaeological record. There is a grave, for example, where we find a man, a woman, and children that are genetically related. And so you might think that that's a family. So we have that kind of information.
Going back how far?
Several thousand years. In terms of written records, the earliest record that we have is the Code of Hammurabi. So 4,000 years ago, roughly, in the Middle East. And then history becomes richer, and so we have more documents, and so we know a lot about how, for example, Roman law, how marriage was understood and how it also changed over time and so on.
What are some examples of how marriage was understood under Roman law?
So marriage was generally strictly monogamous, and it was linked to concepts of legitimacy. So one wife only, it was implied, I suppose, that women had one husband only. And it was linked to, yeah, transferring property. So, for example, adoption was possible at times where a daughter's husband was adopted as a son because you needed to have an heir to be able to transfer property and titles, etc.
Do we know if there was anything resembling marriage or even what we might call monogamous mating in pre-Roman, pre-agricultural, like hunter-gatherer societies?
Those kind of inferences we can make from the genetic data. And some studies have claimed to have found greater variance in reproductive success among men than women, which would suggest a polygynous mating.
Polygynous being?
Being multiple females to one male.
So one man having like multiple wives.
Yeah. Or in this case, mating. So mating
or
partners.
Multiple partners.
Right? We can't tell whether they were necessarily wives.
Right.
We can also look at the range of variation in these practices in present day hunter-gatherers, assuming that that tells us something about mating systems and marriage systems in the past, which is a big assumption to make.
Yeah, may or may not.
May or may not. But that's one way that we can try and make inferences. We can also look at patterns in other primate species. So for example, look at what chimps do, what bonobos do, what gorillas, so all of our sort of cousins, if you like, on the tree of life. So that's one way to try and address these questions.
Do we have hunter-gatherer societies that have been, I mean, I guess anthropology started in the 19th century, right? So the first anthropological records we have are 19th century anthropologists going around the world and making observations, which may or may not have been accurate or biased or whatever, but those are the records we have. Do we have any record of monogamous hunter-gatherer societies?
So we do have early records, of course, from travelers and missionaries, but then the potential for bias is even higher, of course. So the distinction here is between what some anthropologists refer to as socially imposed monogamy and ecologically imposed monogamy. So ecologically imposed monogamy is what we find in many hunter-gatherer populations today, and also historically, well, we have historical records where there is no strong enforcement of monogamy. It's not forbidden, but most men may be monogamous, and that's because supporting multiple wives through hunting, for example, and their children is hard to do. So you might find that in a population, the very skilled hunters have multiple wives, but the majority of men are monogamous. So this is sometimes referred to as ecologically imposed monogamy, to distinguish it from the socially enforced monogamy that you find in Rome, that you find in many Western societies today, where monogamy is enforced.
All of this does make one think about women's freedom, because whenever anything is enforced, it's because somebody wants to do something different. And so one finds oneself wondering, like, enforced monogamy, what's being enforced? Who is right. not getting to do what they really would do otherwise?
Yeah. So that's a really interesting question. I don't think that we have a very good answer to that, in the sense that I can think of three explanations, or this is how the question has been framed. It could be that it's the, let's say, powerful individuals in the group who want to enforce this and they have the power to enforce it on others. Or it could be that it's the less powerful individuals who maybe come together and they manage to eventually get to that point of enforcing it. Or most likely it's some kind of interplay between those two things. And we don't really know whether the, for example, enforced monogamy emerged because it's beneficial for, let's say, the rich men, or it's beneficial for the less rich men, or presumably there's some interaction between those two things going on.
But not beneficial for women.
Well, in my own work, I like to think that it's actually the interplay between the male and female strategies that actually led to monogamous marriage. The old interpretations of marriage systems and mating systems in humans and other species is that males always benefit from mating with multiple females. And so when you do find enforcement of monogamy or a monogamous mating system, it's effectively been interpreted as men giving up polygyny, right? They're relinquishing polygyny. And then you're trying to find an explanation that makes sense for the men. And I find that that's a little biased, because surely you need to look at how it benefits men, how it benefits women, and then the interplay between those two things.
I'm having trouble understanding. I mean, I've heard you say this. You gave a talk the other night about how polygyny, which probably most of our listeners think of as polygamy, but it means one man having multiple mm-hmm. wives. Let's say you have a society in which every married man has three wives. That means that 3/4 of the men have no wives. So when you say benefits men, what about those men who don't have any wives at all?
So that's definitely one factor. So if you have an equal sex ratio, so you have the same numbers of men and women in the population, then the idea is that, yeah, if let's say one man has multiple wives, then some men will go without wives. If you actually look at the demographic data, there are some mechanisms to buffer against that imbalance. For example, a discrepancy in the marriage age between men and women, right? If the men don't marry until they're older, whereas the women can marry a little bit younger, then you don't have as much of an imbalance in the availability of mating partners. What you also find is that divorce or remarriage is allowed. And so effectively, the imbalance is less strong than you would have otherwise. Because, you know, if women can marry multiple times, then maybe one of those men who might not have a wife has an opportunity to marry.
When there has been, for example, a war in which huge numbers of men have been killed, is polygamy more, or polygyny more common?
So it has actually happened, if I recall, about 3 times in European history, where there were wars, so high male mortality, and very Christian countries. It has happened that to make up for the shortage of men, it was decided that men could have multiple wives.
Interesting. Now, let's talk for a moment about polygamy. And I find myself, in talking to you, like having a monogamous bias, because that's how our society is. That's how we're raised. That's how mm-hmm. every movie that's a love story and every love poem and every song that you hear kind of enforces that way of thinking, and the whole idea of your soulmate and all of that. But let's talk for a moment about polygamy, because it is very common, more common than we might think, in human societies. Where is it practiced, and how common is it really, and how does that compare to centuries past?
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to make generalizations about the prevalence of these norms. So the way anthropologists have tried to overcome this difficulty is by looking at samples of societies that have been inscribed ethnographically in the past. So if we look at those standard samples that anthropologists have defined to try and capture a snapshot, if you like, of cultural variation in humans, then we find that a very large majority of societies allow polygyny, about 82% in this one sample that we have. Monogamy is allowed in 17% of these societies, and polyandry, where a woman is allowed to marry multiple husbands at any one time, that's relatively rare. That's found in about 1% of societies in this sample. We do have an understanding that polyandry has been underestimated in the ethnographic record, so it's probably a little bit more common than that.
One of the things that you have seen as an anthropologist is that because monogamy, at least in the Western world, is held up not only as an ideal, but as a universal ideal, and that if there's some sense of progress or evolution mm-hmm. towards something higher, that we are moving toward monogamy, and that that is a good thing. And when that is threatened or challenged, even by the work of an academic anthropologist, people go bananas. How do you understand that? Like, what? Tell us about some of the reactions that you've gotten. Like, you posted some work on Twitter, and people went nuts.
Yeah, there is a very strong attachment to this notion that monogamous marriage is the pinnacle of human progress. There is also this notion that monogamy is what we find in the Bible, and that's not really the case. If you actually read the Bible, there are a lot of different things going on. So, you know, I'm an anthropologist. My interest is in describing the patterns that we see and then bringing that description and understanding to how we understand the world around us. I'm not trying to promote a non-monogamous form of marriage. That's not my role. That's the role of policymakers and philosophers who study ethics. But as anthropologists, my role is to try and understand the variation that we see and to make people aware that there is cross-cultural variation. And the moment we have this appreciation that things vary across societies, then we can move away from notions that there is a natural form of the family, for example.
So basically, there's a lot of different ways historically and anthropologically that people have done families,
yeah.
and they all work within that context.
Absolutely.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is important to talk about is the fact that you don't actually have, I mean, even in monogamous marriage, you don't have sexual exclusivity or what some might call fidelity. That's a reality of marriage, is that people stray outside of marriage. How does that factor into questions about how marriage is defined, what it really is?
So that's where I think it's important to distinguish between what I call the marriage system and the mating system. Because, as you say, you can have a system that enforces monogamous marriage, as we have, but then the mating pattern can be very different from that. So you can have premarital sex, extramarital sex, and the data suggests that this is actually what goes on in many contexts where you have monogamous marriage.
So what is the, I mean, it's funny, we've had this whole conversation about marriage and we have not talked about love or happiness mm-hmm. at all. I mean, what do we know? Are men happy in polygamous marriages, in monogamous marriages?
So my understanding of that aspect is that people haven't necessarily been asked those questions, which is not to say that, for example, jealousy doesn't play a role in this context. But then jealousy is also a thing in monogamous, you know, in societies with strict monogamy. So I would probably say we don't have as good an understanding as we might think. One useful distinction, perhaps, is that you said earlier that we use monogamy and non-monogamy to mean fidelity or lack of fidelity. Very often we also use monogamy in the same way to mean pair bonding. And the implication then is that if you have non-monogamous relationships, you don't have pair bonding, where pair bonding is a special social relationship between two individuals, which might imply love and attachment, etc. And it's fair to say that pair bonding happens in monogamous marriage, in polygynous marriage, in polyandrous marriage.
So much of the conversation in our world now is about things like gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And it's not about reproduction necessarily. People are marrying when they're older. It's not about wealth transfer. It really is about kind of love and self-expression. Is that like a fruit of our modern industrial society?
I would like to think that in some ways that is a relatively modern thing. Love and marriage go together like a horse and carriage, right? That's a relatively modern concept. I think historically it had more to do, so marriage, so the norms and rules had more to do with property, in the way that in European farming communities, marriage was a big deal if there was a lot of wealth to be allocated And if you were a landless farmer, it didn't really matter. I mean, the arrangements were a lot more flexible in who you had children with, and these strong norms didn't really apply in the same way. So I do think that the way we think about marriage and its link with sort of love, it's probably a relatively modern phenomenon.
So would the landless farmer have more freedom to marry somebody that he loved?
I suppose, that's what the evidence seems to suggest, also in terms of having children with multiple partners. Yeah. Nobody was out there sort of asking people these questions, right? So it's all inferential.
How are the worldwide practices of marriage changing as societies come in contact with one another? In other words, there might have been a traditional society that did things one way, and then colonialism is imposed on that society. Mm-hmm. Does the powerful society tend to impose its marriage traditions on the less powerful society?
So that's a really interesting question. I would probably venture that we don't really know the answer, because it's very hard to tease apart what was going on and what exactly drove change, if there was change. The way anthropologists have started thinking about these questions is in terms of resilience. If you find a system that has resisted for many decades, century, to influences from the outside world, then the question you might ask is, why is that system so resilient in that society? And so, for example, if you find polygyny as having persisted for many decades and centuries in some part of the world, despite Christian missionaries coming in and trying to change that to a monogamous system, that you might ask, what is it about the culture that makes polygyny such a resilient system? Is it something about the environment that makes it such a resilient system, or some combination of those different things? And then you might compare that to other parts of the world where there was maybe polygyny, but it wasn't as resilient, right? It was wiped out relatively easily.
You are an academic anthropologist, and you are studying all this stuff as a scientist. All the rest of us are kind of looking at it through our own lenses of our own lives. And some people are very pro-marriage. Some people are very anti-gay. Some people are kind of live and let live. The one thing that we know we have is people have a lot of different ideas about what marriage is, what it should be, whether they want to impose their ideas on other people, and so on. So for you, as an academic, like, what is the role and how does it filter into the outside world of understanding the history and the anthropology of different marriage practices?
Mm-hmm. So in my mind, what anthropology contributes, compared also to other social sciences, is this awareness that these fundamental behaviors like family, marriage, they vary across societies. And an appreciation of that variation, I think, is important to move us away from this notion that there is a natural form of the family and that everything that departs from that is deranged or wrong and we have to fight it, I think. So in my mind, that appreciation is important. It's also important in the context of change. A lot of marriages, for example, in the US nowadays end up in divorce. And so the family is changing also in this country. And an appreciation of how these relationships have been negotiated in different contexts may help us grapple with how our norms change and our own appreciation changes too.
Laura Fortunato is an evolutionary anthropologist at the University of Oxford in England and external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.